Hey, Leo.
Hello again, Stephen.
Are you excited about any of the horror movie television shows that are going to be coming out in the near future, especially franchises like Friday the 13th, Halloween?
Boy, howdy, I should be, but I am more apprehensive than excited because it's going to be so easy to fuck these things up.
Yeah, I got to admit, I'm in the same boat. I'm not that excited about them either. I gave Don Mancini's Chucky show a chance, and I really enjoyed the first season. I enjoyed the first season a lot, and then I never watched another season. Had nothing to do with the show. I thought the first season was great. It was just simply that I just don't watch television. I just don't ever watch TV shows. So yeah, I am very concerned that these are just going to draw out parts of the lore that I could care less about.
I'm especially concerned about that with the Friday the 13th serial that's coming out. We talked about this before. I don't want to see his dad. I don't care about the early life of Pamela Voorhees. I'm not interested in young Jason traipsing through the woods.
Yeah, I can't imagine what kind of backstory they're going to give us on a movie that was a ripoff of Halloween.
I know. My sincere hope is that it sort of fills in the gaps between the movies. So the people who died in part two, for example, and then we get to see what Jason's doing in between his home ec class or whatever the fuck he's doing until part three happens.
We get to see his growth hormone spurt where he becomes a completely different size between part two and part three.
That's right, exactly. He's just hitting the gym a lot. He's just fucking going for it.
Look, I love Friday the 13th movies, but the idea that that movie is going to strict like to canon, and I've read things about that. They're like, we're really concerned about the canon. The canon? He looks different in three movies.
I mean, if we're very lucky, perhaps this film will do what we talked about before and talk about the people who live around the lake and what they have to go through dealing with Jason, which would be at least interesting.
Right.
I can't imagine anything else being worth a shit.
Maybe they'll do what those fan films did. We talked about this in an early episode where they always have these fan films will always bring back one of the old actresses who's like one of the final girls from the other movie. But the way they connect them to the story is they're always living near the lake.
That's right. They found like a bed and breakfast down the road.
Look, and I like some of these movies. I think that they're really fun, you know, or interesting. But I've always just found that a little ridiculous that the final girl just was like, I've got to get away from this horrible thing that happened. And I can go to the other side of the lake right over there.
He won't find me at Packanack Lodge across the lake.
Right. Exactly. All right, everybody. Welcome to Spoils of Horror. My name is Steven.
I am Leo.
And this is episode number 123, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, part two.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
I would like to say that it was hinted at in the last episode, but it wasn't. You full-on told me straight to my face that there were two very distinct reasons why you chose this movie. So now I get to say, why did we choose this movie all over again?
So I told you before that it was a movie that I saw when I was a kid and liked it, and then I realized it was horrible when I watched it as a 40-year-old. But I have another strange connection to this movie. When I was probably 21, 22 years old, I got cast in a play production of Frankenstein. It was the first time I was ever in a show that had a lot of money behind it. Mm-hmm. So it was like big elaborate sets, big elaborate special effects, different things like that. My character had his neck broken and was thrown into a burning building. It was very cool.
Oh, you told me that story. Yeah.
Yep. It was very, very, very cool. But what I didn't tell you is that the script was rewritten from the script that you can buy because the director, who was only like a year older than me, was so psychotically into this movie that he stole a lot of it.
Really? Or it's
not stole, but inspired. Oh, yeah. So the overdramatic nature of this movie was in that play.
Oh, and, no.
And there are a lot of scenes. So the scene that we talked about last week where we talked about the creature attacking the town, we had that scene in our play.
Wow. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It didn't look nearly as good. Let's just say that. But I did, I played a street urchin peasant, you know, whatever, yeah, you know, yeah. One of the people that they throw dirt on their face and they just wrap them up in cloth.
For sure. Yeah.
And the creature actually grabbed my neck. He was played by a 6'7" actor, picked me up. They had special effects that they could pick me up, yeah. Broke my neck and then tossed me into the crowd. It was very cool. And now I look back and realize that it was a pretty ridiculous production.
Sometime when we do our next Dracula rendition of something or another, remind me to tell you about my experience of almost getting cast in the Dracula play, which was a shitty time.
Well, I will tell you this. I do think that they mysteriously cut the fact that Elizabeth was Victor's sister.
Weird. How weird. That's
weird that that didn't make it in.
I mean, technically not sister. I don't know. Whatever. But
whatever. Anyway, shall we cover this movie now?
Yes, let's do it.
Frankenstein's creature walks through the woods, hearing the faint sounds of a flute in the distance. There's a small home in the wilderness. The creature hides inside the barn, feeds on pig scraps, and falls asleep in a pile of hay. Over several months, the creature bonds with the farm's owner, a kind-hearted family, by watching them from afar. He performs tasks to help them with their difficult life. They think he's a forest spirit, helping with their harvest. He watches them over a period of time, listens as the children learn to read, and begins to sound out the words in Victor's journal, learning where he comes from. Shortly after Christmas, a series of misunderstandings cause the family to chase the creature from their home. His heart is broken. When he returns to the hut, everyone is gone. Burning the house to the ground, the creature vows vengeance on his creator and begins his journey to Geneva.
There's an important distinction that happened in this film that I really admire. In the credits of the film, you'll see that they changed the name for De Niro's character to the creature, not the monster. And I think that makes a stronger impact. I think it's a very deliberate change, of course, but it changes the character a lot because he's not a monster. He's just a creature. He's a guy. He's a thing. He's a whatever. I know. Sometimes the best thing you can do for people is a simple name change to give them a new life or a new attitude or what have you. I don't know that the creature would have chosen the fairy of the forest as his right moniker, but he certainly appreciated that more than creature or monster, I'm sure.
That's what the mean kids in Maine used to call me when they were making fun of me. If you guys don't get that joke, listen to any previous episode. So when Robert De Niro's character, who plays the creature, or sometimes called the creation too, which I actually thought was a wise choice. Also I thought it was a neat choice. When he shows up at this hut, there's just a couple of things here that are very funny. So first of all, there is an entire family living in this hut. It's not the general blind man that we usually see in the other Frankenstein stories. There is a blind man, but there's also an entire family.
But he's
family
not a hermit like he's been represented as before. Yeah,
exactly. No, now he's a grandfather leeching off of a family.
That's right. Is that Willy Wonka all over again?
Yes, exactly. But this family is the most hilariously clean, like woodland pauper family that I've ever seen.
Yeah, the poor orphan girl that's now your adopted sister who you're going to marry and love forever looked more like what we should have seen out here than
right.
These kids who look like they just built a summer home and are having a good time.
They look like the opposite of Pigpen, that is, as opposed to like how Pigpen attracts dirt, they repel it. Because they're walking around in this dirty house, but they're perfectly clean. Yeah.
It's not dirt in their faces. There's no dirt under their fingernails. They're not working hard. They're just bitching that life is hard. They're not actually working for nothing.
It looks like you're watching a colonial reenactment video. Exactly. And the reason I say this, and we kind of preempted this in the last episode, is we're not looking to make fun of these poor characters. So we call them street urchins and orphans and peasants and whatnot. It's because they are so stereotypically played in this movie in that way. This family's charming, whereas in the city, they're all played just like sad people carrying around rotten carrots.
Yeah, go figure, the ones who decide to move off the grid are having a better life than the ones who live in the city.
I'm telling you, this movie loves, it loves its right-wingers. We decided that was with the vaccine. Now, this is a homesteading family.
Exactly. We're going to quarantine as far from you fuckers as possible.
I don't want my kids having that liberal education.
Is it like Appalachian households up in the mountains?
Yeah, with Southern accents, apparently.
That's right.
But of course, this is another scene where we get the creature learning to read as he's watching this family, which of course he's reading out loud, which I pointed out in the last episode is very funny to me that every single character has to do everything out loud. But also, he lives in this barn, and it is implied that he lives there for months because we watch seasons change. He learns how to talk better. He learns how to read. He learns all these other things. But this barn is so fucking small. It is like the size of a Brooklyn apartment. And so the idea that Robert De Niro's character hid inside there for months is insane to me. I am not one of those people that needs for the Joker to explain how he got the bombs on the boat. But Jesus fucking Christ, this creature is able to appear and disappear whenever it needs to and is able to hide behind small beams and like little pieces of furniture. And it's huge.
They would have had to have utilized the barn at some point. This family had it there for a reason, whether it was livestock or storage or what have you. So they're going in there probably on a daily basis.
Right.
And he's got to, I don't know, duck under the bales of hay and squeak like a mouse if they hear something move. Or he's got up in the fucking rafters and is hanging there, just like holding on, hoping they don't look up.
Yes. Like his character in Cape Fear.
Exactly. Exactly that.
Hanging on to the bottom of the car.
Hoping they don't drive over a cactus patch.
Right, right. Yes. Here's looking at you, The Simpsons. I remember that joke too.
There you go.
I'll put these things in the show notes. I love the movie Cape Fear.
Cape Fear is great.
We could cover Cape Fear. That's a horror movie.
Oh, don't think I haven't thought about it. Yeah.
Ooh. I didn't think we'd ever get to cover a Scorsese movie.
Yeah, I don't know what on earth possessed them to think that he could evade them. Maybe he just, every day at 9 a.m., he got out before they did and wandered the woods and carved his initials in trees and shit.
What I like to think is that he hollowed out one of those pigs. And so you have a scene where one of the characters like walks in the barn and he sees all the pigs, you know, like walking around. And there's one pig that's just sitting up on a hay bale and it's just totally inanimate, just standing there. And then when the farmer walks out, Robert De Niro's heads come up and he's just wearing the pig on the top of his head.
It's like that walrus suit in the Tusk movie.
Yes, he's just wearing it like a little coonskin hat. Let's get the big negative out of this half of the movie out of the way right now. Robert De Niro is fucking horrible in this movie. He's horrible.
I don't love saying that. I don't love saying that because I actually genuinely respect him as an actor. Mm-hmm. I think he's good, but every actor has a film or two that are just not great. And I begrudgingly have to agree with you. He's done so much better in so many other roles, and I have to attribute that to what we said before, the fucking writing, the everything, because he's such a good actor. There's no reason he couldn't have been good in this movie, except that he just couldn't be good in this movie.
It is less like the creature is played by Robert De Niro and more like the creature is played by Jake LaMotta.
Yeah.
Like if you've ever seen the movie Raging Bull, Raging Bull is one of my favorite movies that has ever been made. I think it is one of my top five favorite movies of all time. And it is like Robert De Niro's character, Jake LaMotta, is playing the creature. You know, he's got a puffed up lip and he's and he's barely getting words out, which is exactly like that character in the movie because he's a boxer and he barely speaks in the movie. You know, the famous scene where he looks at Joe Pesci in Raging Bull and says, "Did you fuck my wife?" I swear to God, I thought that was going to happen. I thought that the creature was going to look at Kenneth Branagh and say, "Did you fuck my wife?"
Yeah, what? Well, this movie's going in the other direction for that, but that's okay. Right. But I get it, though. I get what you're saying. And it's, I don't know. I really struggled because I knew Robert De Niro was in the movie. And I knew, I wasn't ignorant. I knew he played the creature. But I'm watching this happen. And especially as we get to this part, this later half in the film, I'm watching him portray the creature. And I'm like, where's Robert De Niro? I thought he was in this film. And that sucks. That sucks to look at somebody so fucking talented and go, where the fuck are you?
I had trouble admitting to myself that he was bad in this movie. I had trouble. And it wasn't until he has a good scene, which is the scene in the ice cave, in my opinion. That scene is a good scene.
Yeah.
And he has good material to work with, and he does well in it. But this part in the beginning that is just is meant to like elicit our empathy, and it's very much the same in the book. Like the first third of the book is about Victor, and the last half of the book is about Victor, or the last third, but the middle third is about the creature. And I've always liked that design. You know, some people find it kind of off-putting. I like it. I think it serves to get the creature to be sympathetic and someone you care about, and it makes the story more complicated.
Yeah.
That does not work here at all. It is just watching the creature barely interact with this family, so you don't really have any connection between him and them. You know, he enjoys their kindness. I do like the whole woodland spirit thing, but you don't really get any sense of him just because the performance is so stilted and non-present.
That's the right word. It's like he was delivering the lines and doing the scenes and performing in the role while thinking about his grocery list or something. Right. He just wasn't there while he was doing it. And maybe that was a choice. I'd like to think he's talented and been around long enough that he made the choice to be, my character is going to be like a child or an infant, and I'm going to stunt myself and slow down, but it did not work.
And he's got the same overdramatic nature that Kenneth Branagh has in the first half of the movie. And I wonder to myself, was there some kind of tone that was supposed to be in this film that is just not present for us as an audience? You and I, when we covered Silence of the Lambs, we made a case that the Roger Corman luridness of his cheap B-movies is very much baked into Silence of the Lambs, and it makes it better. I'm wondering if there was some sort of conversation where Kenneth Branagh and Robert De Niro were talking about that this was going to be like the old Universal monster movies, that this was going to be like theater, that this was going to be larger than life and operatic and big and dramatic, and it just fundamentally fucking doesn't work, and it makes it look ridiculous.
I think that might be part of it too, because you say operatic, and that's accurate. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to make a blockbuster, you're trying to make a Universal monster film, you're trying to make something new and original, you're trying to spend the budget and make it worth that expenditure by making everything so huge, you're trying to make an opera, I think they just went for too many different options and tried to do all of them rather than saying, this is the tone, this is what we're going for, let's nail it.
And you can make a movie that's both a genre film and operatic. Mm-hmm. I think of the great martial arts movie Hero. Hero is a great martial arts film, but it is like, again, it's like watching an opera. It's like larger than life. Everything's huge. Everything's big. The, you know, the tapestries are big and the colors are big. And it's a wonderful movie that you would never take serious. It's like watching mythology.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that.
And maybe that's what this movie wants to be. It just royally fails.
Yeah.
I mean, when the creature burns down the hut, because the family moved out, which good for them.
Also, yeah, good job. Get out of town while you can.
And then he looks like straight into the camera, turns around and says like, I will have my revenge.
It's the worst part of the movie.
It's so over the top. And I just keep thinking to myself, well, like what happens 3 seconds later when he has to like put his hands down and just start walking or open up a map or ask for directions to Geneva?
I hated that. I know it was the big moment in the movie. I swear there's an interview out there somewhere where somebody's going to compliment it and be like, oh, it was so dramatic and so huge. And I'm like, this is dumb. This is like fucking Anakin Skywalker at the end of episode 3 going, no!
Right.
It was stupid. And again, what I said in the last part of this fucking show, why does he need revenge? He ran out of the lab on his own. He took a coat and ran into the woods. Yeah, the city was mad at him and treated him like shit and punched him on the way out. But right. Victor, all he did was cry and go to sleep. What fucking revenge do you need that you have to burn these guys' house down and then go kill him?
I guess it's supposed to be the revenge for giving him life. But even then, I feel that it's a little rushed to get there.
Exactly.
There's scenes in this farm section that I like. I like the idea that he helps with the frozen crops. He helps pull like radishes out of the ground because they're frozen into the ground. I like the fact
to be a good person by doing that, which is a great character development.
And I do really like the scene where the kids leave cookies out for him because they think he's some kind of like Christmas forest spirit. I really do like that. There is a part where it shows inside the house and it shows the family sitting in front of the fireplace and there's like boughs of holly around. And I thought to myself, this looks less like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and more like Mary Shelley's Christmas special, but but I did enjoy some of it. I just feel like you need to have a longer scene between the creature and the blind man and for them to actually form a friendship. Have him actually form a friendship with the blind man and then have the blind man keep it a secret for a while and then have the family discover it. The family freaks out and then they move out and they just, you know, like grandpa gets knocked out on accident. Yeah. And, you know, so they just carry him out and we never find out what happens.
The dad freaking out about the creature and the thing that people do, human beings do, where, oh, you look hideous and frightening, so I'm going to freak out and attack you. That's just human nature. I can dig that, but you're absolutely right. You need to establish the relationship between these two as a tighter bond or at least a longer lasting relationship than what we got in order for that to have any real impact on us.
And if you want to say that they can't change anything because of the book, well, I don't think that some of the action sequences that are in this movie are in the book. So they make changes. And I would say that you have the creature accidentally kill the blind man. Accident, total accident. You know, like he kills the little girl in the original 1930s Frankenstein. And then the family misunderstands. Mm-hmm. So you have something like that where you can sympathize with the creature, but something terrible did happen. Right. As opposed to, I don't mind the fact that they have the debt collector. I don't mind that. Yeah, I think that works.
The landlord, you know, whatever he was, yeah.
Exactly, but you just, the problem is they're not just giving this section to breathe, and I don't want to buy the whole idea that like, oh, you can't make the movie longer than 2 hours. Well, then don't choose a story that's this long.
Is in 94, they weren't doing these 3 hour epics. We could sit through a 3 hour movie, 3.5 hour movie now, like it's nothing. We've been conditioned like fucking Marvel movies and stuff. We're like, 3 hours, whatever. I remember Schindler's List came out at about 3 hours back in the day, and they had to do an intermission in between because people wouldn't sit through it without one.
Yeah, Titanic, they did it too.
Yeah. Back then, they weren't doing these big epic films of that caliber. So to your point, don't do it.
Can I tell you one of my favorite stories about my parents? And it has to do with the movie Titanic. Little side story, but I think the audience will appreciate it. I'd seen horror movies all my life. I'd watched horror movies with my parents. And then they went and saw the movie Titanic and they came back. It was like their date night. And they came back and they sat me down. And I'll never forget this. Like, I thought they were going to ask me like if I was like committing crimes or gay or something. Like, they sat me down. It's like a big deal. It's a big deal. And they said, "Steven, we think you should go see the movie Titanic. It is really important. But we want to warn you, there is a scene of nudity in it, but it's very tastefully done." And I thought to myself, you guys know that I've seen nudity in movies, right? Like, I also like wasn't a virgin at the time either, so there was that too. I know what
naked people are, Mom. God.
Right. I mean, I know I was a nerd, but you know, I always love that story. I give them a hard time about that story all the time. I love that story about my parents.
That's astounding.
Just how drunk are we gonna get?
Welcome to Good Beer, Bad Movie Night, where each month we drink finely crafted brews while watching terrible films in order to see just how drunk you have to get to enjoy them. So tune in and join Troy.
Kilmoy Kreitz.
Oh, that was pretty good.
Thank you.
Dave.
I have the weirdest boner.
And Pete. IPAs are ales, meaning they are bottom fermented. Excuse me, they are top fermented. I f*** that up. Try that again. As we drag Kathleen.
Hear me.
kicking and screaming through an alcohol-fueled podcast dedicated to movies of questionable quality and the frosty adult beverages that help make them tolerable. Good Beer Bad Movie Night. Clearly, it's the beer's fault.
Much has changed for Victor Frankenstein. He's moved back to Geneva, gotten engaged to Elizabeth, and hired Henry to practice medicine for his ailing father. William Frankenstein, Victor's younger brother, wanders into the woods to show a locket to a friend. He finds the creature sitting on a fallen tree, playing a flute. Hours later, a search party finds William dead. A longtime servant of the Frankenstein family named Justine is found with William's locket. The creature placed it on her dress as she slept. The townspeople quickly find out, and assuming she murdered the young boy, carry her into the town square and have her hanged. Victor watches in horror, knowing his creation actually committed the crime. After receiving a threatening message, Victor heads into the snow-capped mountains surrounding his estate to face the creature. He quickly falls into a cave of ice and is knocked unconscious.
We've talked about this before. I get very opinionated about movies telling me too much or too little, and it seems like every other film I'm kind of going back and forth about it, and I try not to have an inconsistent message there. I don't understand how Victor immediately associated this woman's death to the creature did it, because he moved to Geneva, leaving the creature behind as if it were dead, or, well, fuck him, he ran off into the woods, it's somebody else's problem now. How did he automatically be like, oh, this must have been the creature coming after? Like, I don't get where he leapt to that logic.
One of my favorite things that you and I have ever said, and I've referenced this probably five or six times in this show, is our Howling 2 episode, which we referenced last week. We said, is the performance of Stilba good, bad, or does it matter? Is it some sort of like, it's like some sort of like those Chinese finger traps. No matter how, which way you pull it, you end up going nowhere. I think trying to make sense of this section of the film is the same Japanese cone. It is answering that question is like the sound of one hand clapping. Like there's so much in here that makes no sense to me. I agree with you completely. I don't know why Victor would ever associate William's murder with the creature, but I don't even want to start there. I want to start with the fact that the creature leaves a house in the wilderness of Germany and walks all the way to Geneva, but not even just walks, like walks as the crow flies, like just straight.
Yeah, like straight line, like on an Indiana Jones map, just whoop. I can't imagine how. It's beyond me. I'm sitting here trying to be funny about it, and I can't even wrap my fucking brain around how. And to the point that Victor in Geneva, not a lot of time has passed between. So that fucker must have sprinted to Geneva.
Oh, here's where it's even more ridiculous. The creature gets there first. The
also
creature
that
gets there before Elizabeth and Victor left.
Yeah,
and went home.
Yeah.
I don't know if they stopped for snacks along the way, like a lot. Like,
but also, they had money. They could have rented fucking guides and boats and carriages and wagons and stuff. The creature had to hoof it or get on a donkey or something. You know what I mean? Like, what the fuck?
I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't know if they have some sort of like technology that we're unaware of, some sort of steampunky car.
That's what it was. It was a fucking airship. It was one of those blimps.
Sort of Jules Verne type.
One of those fucking steam-powered mechanical pieces of shit that everyone's obsessed with.
But even then, they didn't get there first. The creature did. So yeah. I don't, like, I'm trying to, like, balance the technology. I'm stuck between them taking some sort of Jules Verne flying machine, and then the creature, this is going to be very esoteric, but Leo will get it. I'm picturing the hang glider from the movie Cave Dwellers.
Yes. Yes, that. Exactly that.
Yes. Cave Dwellers is one of the greatest bad movies ever made for our audience. And you should go and watch it. And you should go and watch the Mystery Science Theater movie version of it. But there is a part where a barbarian uses like sticks and twigs to make a hang glider. And it is like one of the greatest things in all of cinema.
The thing of this is, the only reason I'm focusing on it at all, and not to beat the dead horse, it speaks to this movie being so disjointed.
Yeah.
And it just not bringing together what it needs to, you have to do certain things that make sense in order to get to the next section of your film. And if you don't, it stops me. My brain, I don't know if this is anyone else, but it actually makes me stop and go, what the fuck? And that takes me away from the story you're telling, because now I have other shit in my head that I'm worrying about or thinking over.
Well, and there's so much going on at the same time, too. We have this whole story with the creature, and then we have these like sweeping helicopter shots of him walking, you know, across the mountains of, you know, Germany.
Carpathia or whatever.
I know. Like he's like he's the Fellowship of the Ring, like they're walking.
The greatest adventure.
It's been too long since we've sung that on this show.
Oh, amazing.
But at the same time, we have this story happening of Victor moving from, you know, Germany to Geneva. And then we have this, you know, whole thing where he's hired Henry to be a doctor at the house, and he's brought back Elizabeth, and, you know, Elizabeth and him are going to get married and whatnot. And then you're experiencing all their emotions too about it. And it's such a bizarre scene. Like, they're in the lab and Victor asks Elizabeth to marry him, or hints that they're going to get married. She hugs Henry. Henry and her run back around and they start chasing each other around a pole.
Yeah.
While you're also having this scene where the creature is walking from one place to another across thousands and thousands of miles. And just trying to put all this stuff together in your head is bizarre. Like, what are the relationships between these characters? How far apart are they? Who do they know? Why am I watching these three run around when one of them's getting married? This movie is rated R for excessive frolicking. Like, there's too much. There's too many scenes where characters are excited for one another, and they're just like running around, like sort of dancing in maypole circles. I began to think that maybe Henry and all of them were excited because it was the first day of their polycule. Like, I'm so confused.
He's invited you to stay, Henry. Wink, 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 wink.
Right. Do you know what spit roasting means?
I could presume that it's the juxtaposition of the creature having to go through such arduous shit while Henry and Victor and Elizabeth are living up a fanciful and lovely life, and their life is going out well while his life is going to shit. And that's should be good storytelling. But again, they just didn't nail it. They didn't. It's so fucked up.
This is like the bottom of the barrel for this movie. They go into the wilderness because William has gotten lost. We know the creature has killed him. But of course, everybody's got to form a search party to find him. This search party, it should not be this funny watching people look for a dead kid.
You're right.
Because the drama is so over the top and everybody is running around with like their hair is caught on fire. Now, I believe, of course, that looking for a missing kid would be very dramatic. What I don't believe is that you would have characters that are literally running around like the same tree being like, William, like flipping over rocks and shit, seeing if he's under there. It's just so crazy. And the drama is so heightened.
Playing, you
know, the big music is playing. And I want to reference a scene from part one.
Yeah.
In part one, there is a moment where Elizabeth and Justine is like the maid of the house. She's lived with them her whole life, and she's also in love with Victor. And the two of them have this scene where they're talking about the cholera epidemic that's happening in Germany and like all these other things that are happening in life. And the two of them are like screaming at each other. Mm-hmm. And all I'm thinking is, why are we yelling? Like, who are,
right,
why?
Yeah.
Like, why are we yelling at each other? Like, you're on like a vista in front of a lake in the middle of nowhere. Why are we yelling at each other? Why is the music so dramatic? Why do we have to speak in all caps? Why?
What a very modern way of putting that. Good job.
Right. And the search party, isn't it the same? Like, it's like everything is just so crazy and harried, only for the big reveal to be Elizabeth walking out of the woods that night. And Harry is in her arms. And she's like, he's dead. Harry's dead. And they lay him on the ground and he is certainly not dead.
Not at all. No, I don't know who taught the kid to act, but they didn't teach him how to hold his breath. I'll tell you that much.
Not only that, they put a blanket around him and he literally, his arm reaches up and grabs the blanket and pulls it around himself.
It's like, fucking hell, kid. Come on. Somebody do take two, please.
Oh, that's what dolls are for.
Also that.
I was like, did that kid just reach up and grab his own blanket and pull it over his body?
I was going to bring that up if you didn't, because what the fuck, dude? Like, this is exactly why film is miraculous in allowing us to have another take. I don't know if people weren't paying attention or if by the time they got to the editing process, they were like, ah, fuck it, I'm done.
I don't know if they needed $45 million and $1 to fix this scene. But this is just so ludicrous.
And I think that honestly sums up a lot of this. When we keep talking about how this movie's so disjointed and how it doesn't come together as well as we want and all that, the fact that that is even reality, the fact that that exists in this movie speaks to how poorly this movie is put together.
And it leads to what should be one of the best scenes in the film, and probably the other great performance, which is a minor character, is Justine. We have this moment where the characters think she has the locket on her because the creature planted on her, which I always thought was fucking stupid. Like, I never liked the idea of the creature planting evidence.
I like that he learns so much by reading that fucking diary of Victor's that he's like, I know how to scheme and plot now. Yeah.
Victor was very into true crime podcasts, so he knew, he knew a lot. But I've always liked that they accidentally thought it was her. I've always thought that that was like one of the most tragic parts of the whole story. And that's the part where the theater person in me kind of comes out in a proud way. Like, it reminds me of reading like Oedipus Rex or Hamlet or something, where like, or Othello, where just like my heart would like sink into my chest as I saw these terrible, tragic things happening to characters. Yeah. I used to love tragedies. I get excited during this part because I want it to work so badly. Mm-hmm. And I think that the woman playing Justine and the woman playing her mother are fantastic in these scenes. But the whole moment between when they actually accuse Justine of the crime to when they actually hang her from the gallows is 2 minutes. It's so fast.
And when you're talking about trying to build tension in a story, when you're trying to talk about building character, when you're trying to talk about everybody has a relationship with this woman and now that's being torn asunder and da-da-da. Mm-hmm.
And they all love her, yeah. She's like part of their family.
But then, oh, shock, this happened? Is it real? Oh, my God. And then we want to defend her. Oh, we don't have time to defend her because we got to get this movie going. So they scream from the crowd, she's not guilty, and they say, fuck you, and hang her.
and it's so fast. Literally, people show up at the door of the Frankenstein house and they say, we believe it was just Justine. We found the locket on her. And then it cuts immediately to a crowd of people running through the streets and Victor looking at Henry and going, they must have broken into the jail and pulled her out.
Like, weren't you just in the house? Why are you downtown? What is happening?
What have you been doing for the last couple weeks? What's happened between then and now? Let me tell you something else I love about this movie. And this is prominent in the first section, the part one and part two. Uh-huh. I love the like random peasant crowd in this film. Skyrim is one of the biggest video games that's ever been made. So most people should understand this reference. But you know how when you're in that video game and there's a little chicken running around, and if you take your sword and you whack that chicken, the entire town will attack you.
Yes.
That is exactly what this town is like. This town is like the Borg. Like they all operate on a hive mind. Isn't it true?
I've heard of small towns before where everybody knows everyone and all the little secrets and all the everything that's going on. There's gossip all over the place. I've never seen it this bad.
It's so bad. I'm crying because it makes me laugh so much. Every single time they need the crowd to do something, all of the crowd does the same exact thing at the same time.
It's like they gave one direction through a megaphone. All right, like, Jeff, I need you to run left and scream. And everyone heard, run left and scream? Got it. Whoosh.
When they attack the creature, the entire town attack the creature.
Yeah.
Babies will drop their rattles to attack the creature. The sick are healed and get up and attack the creature.
It's fighting time, boys.
And it's the same with this scene. Like, you're telling me that the town, like, that nobody else had anything to do, that the town heard that Justine killed some random kid, you know, like, out in the wilderness, and then all of them, hundreds of them, broke into the jail and dragged her out for a hanging.
And Geneva's a big enough place. Some of these people don't know who the Frankensteins are. Some of these people don't give a shit. Some of these people probably wanted to see the bitch hang just because she fronted them at the store or something. I'm not convinced the baker is going to just close his shop and come running out here to be part of this.
Don't some people work at the bank? Like, don't they have like a job? And there's an early scene where I love it too. There's a scene in part one. Part one is we divided them, where Elizabeth shows up at Victor's house and says, hey, I want you to come back because of cholera. And he says, no. And then she runs out and she starts running down the road. She's like, Henry, for some unanswerable reason, runs after her and is screaming, you know, Elizabeth, come back. But they have the entire town walking in the opposite direction, like he's walking, like he's running upstream.
Yes.
And it's ridiculous. It's every single person in the town. I don't know if there was like a Black Christmas sale on bread, or like a, you know, like a, sorry, Black Christmas, that a great movie.
Black Christmas sale. I want to go to that sale.
It's a DVD sale. It's a DVD sale. It's they're releasing the 4K. It's got a new slip cover and everything.
Oh, Steelbook's out. Gotta go.
Yes, yeah, Steelbook's out. Steelbook's out. I don't need to buy carrots this week.
The kale can wait, Jennifer. Let's go.
Yes.
Shit.
What is it? What is it? Black Sunday? What's the day? What do they call that day after Thanksgiving?
Black Friday.
Black Friday. Thank you. Black Sunday. That's probably a movie too.
Black Sabbath. Who cares? Whatever.
It was a Black Sabbath concert is what it was.
It was Pancake Thursday. They had to go to Denny's and get their shit.
Victor wakes to find the creature sitting across from him. They have a long conversation about the nature of existence and the ethics of creating life after death. The creation is filled with loneliness, fury, and rage, but would like to make a deal. If his creator will make a female companion, the creature will travel with her to the North Pole, never to be seen again. Victor returns home and rebuilds his lab, eager to uphold his end of the bargain. The promise is broken moments later when the creature wants to use Justine's body. Things start moving faster. Elizabeth and Victor break up, make up, get married, and try to escape the creature's wrath. Somewhere in here, their father is murdered, or dies of old age, or Ian Holm has been hypnotized. It's a little unclear. What you need to know is that Dad dies and our heroes try to escape, but end up taking shelter at a nearby lodge. That night, the creature sneaks inside their room and rips out Elizabeth's heart.
There's something in here about the beginnings of the incel movement where he feels that he can just tell Victor to get him a woman and make it everything he wants it to be, and that she'll just love him no matter what.
I love Robert De Niro's line in this section. He says, "The sympathy of one living being would make me make peace with all." That tells me something big about his character. If he thinks that having a girlfriend will help him make peace with everything, he has never been in a relationship.
My father had to come home and deal with my mother every day, and he went out and became an alcoholic. So that shows how that works.
Look, I've always loved this part of the story when he says, like, you have to make me a mate. I've always thought it was very complicated, very morally complicated, very ethically complicated, very interesting for the character. But it is funny to think about them 1 year later in the North Pole of all places.
She's like, creature, could we please move to somewhere warm?
Right. Well, if you wouldn't bitch at me all the time.
We're having fish or penguin or polar bear. What did you beat up today?
Yeah. Well, we can't grow anything here because you want to live close to your parents. This whole scene in the ice fascinates me. It starts off with a very bizarre intro. Literally, Victor Frankenstein is standing in his front yard of his place in Geneva talking to someone, and that person turns around and leaves, and Victor just turns around and finds the creature standing directly behind him. I don't know if part of the whole scene where the Victor was putting together all the different body parts of all the different criminals and pickpockets and murderers that he stole body parts from, if he also got the feet of a ballerina. But but somehow the creature is able to just magically show up places.
I love the idea. I don't know what the name of it is, but that pose where they put their hands up over their head like this yes. and start tiptoeing across the stage.
I love the idea because the creature has a wonderful line where he says, there are things I know how to do and I don't know why I know how to do them. Because sure. I don't know if the memory is in the hands or the brain. I love the idea that he's doing those little tippy toes places and being like, I don't know where this comes from. Where?
Did you give me the dainty feet of a woman?
So then the creature says to Victor, I want you to meet out me out there. And he kind of like points into the horizon and says, into the sea of ice.
Yeah.
And look, the sea of ice better be a fucking restaurant that's at the top of that mountain. Because there's no discernible way that you would have any idea where the creature wants you to meet him. He better have handed Victor a pamphlet for a tourist attraction called the Sea of Ice.
Maybe you're right. You know those restaurants they had a little while back that were all made out of ice
yes,
on the inside?
Exactly.
That's what it was.
Meet me here at the Sea of Ice and I will extract my revenge. It's open from 10 a.m. till 7 p.m.
Could be late.
Closed on Sundays. But you can still order online.
That's fucking great.
So this whole scene already doesn't make any sense because, you know, Victor has to like scale icy walls and he has to like go through again. And it's all drama. It's all like you can't just like pick a place that Frankenstein's creature would say like, okay, like meet me there and we're going to have our final battle, which I'd be fine with. Mm-hmm. But I like the whole part where, you know, Victor has to explain to everybody he's got to go and fight this creature and he can't tell them what it is. Yeah. And he's got these cool like guns and, you know, like I don't mind even a little bit of steampunkiness to this movie if the movie would own it and stop pretending that it's not doing it.
Exactly that. Thank you. It's so obvious. And I guess in 94, steampunk was all the shit. But seriously, either commit to this gimmick or don't.
Right.
Because you're right in that fucking line and you're going up and down and up and down. Pick a path. That's
yeah.
all it is.
Look, I don't know if those guns are real, but they look like six shooters and they look kind of cool.
Sure.
They look kind of cool.
I wouldn't mind seeing that in action. That would have been great. But nah, they're not doing it.
Because
that's the thing. They'll give us this cool looking gun, but then they will fucking fire the thing and use it.
That was my review of this when I was 15 years old. There was never enough fighting for me in movies. And so yeah. I would watch a movie like this and be like, it was cool, but they sure had a big fight at the end.
Fucking guys.
But it also does lead to probably one of the better scenes in the film, which is that Victor gets knocked out. He kind of falls into this ice slide chute, but he ends up in this cave and the creature and Victor have a discussion in this cave, which I think is one of the better points of the film where it kind of captures what we want the film to be about, which is a serious discussion about what are the ethics of life and death and what does it mean that Victor didn't really take the time to think this through, that he never thought about the ethics of his decision. He never thought about how it might affect somebody else.
What I love about this scene in the book as well as the film, and a lot of other movies don't bother to have this scene included, is that it brings Victor face to face with his consequences. Because he made this thing and then he was repulsed by it and he walked away from it. And he thought, I'll never see it again. Fuck that thing. And now, literally face to face with it, forced to sit and talk to it, confront it. It's almost like a therapy session. Like, what did you think was going to happen? How did you figure this was going to go? And it was an important moment for Victor's character development. In the book, he never consented to making the female for him. He was like, nope, never again. Fuck you. Not going to happen. In this one, they went a different direction. I don't even fault that. I think it was a fine choice for an ending of the film. But to be able to have that moment where you're forcing Victor's hand and making him really think about what he's done and making him really take accountability in a way he didn't expect to have to, that's the important part of this film. And for that, I agree with you. This is a really powerful moment in the movie. For all the shit I'm taking out of this film, best parts of it.
Yeah. So there's a question that the creature asks that I really like. He says, two people are dead because of us. And I like he says us because it speaks to his character. It doesn't speak that he's right. It just speaks to how he feels. Two people are dead because of us. Why? Mm-hmm. He's genuinely asking Victor a question there. Why? And it reminds me of when somebody had something bad happen to them and they're still kind of caught up in that victim mentality. And they're asking, why did this happen to me? Terrible car accident. A family member is killed. Why did this happen to me? It's an unanswerable question.
Yeah.
Because it's random. Random events happened, or, you know, or somebody did something cruel to you. You know, I went through my own stage of that when I went through like my terrible breakup. Was I just kept asking, why did this happen to me? Yeah. And the answer is because I dated somebody who did something insanely cruel. That's why. Mm-hmm. That's why. That's it. That's all there is.
Yeah.
Because you happen to have somebody in your orbit that did something insanely cruel. That's it. That's all that happened. Or you did something insanely cruel because you weren't thinking, or, you know, whatnot.
I had a cousin that died because he got in a car accident. The car accident happened simply because the girl driving the other car was busy putting her makeup on in the mirror as she was driving.
Exactly.
He couldn't have predicted that. He was just going to the store or whatever. And now he's dead because of her.
And that's one thing that I find really interesting is when he asks that unanswerable question. Why did this happen to me? But there's no answer other than Victor made a creation that he didn't really anticipate was going to have its own thoughts and feelings. Mm-hmm. He just simply made it, and you are the thing that he made. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's all there is. So I really think that this part actually gets to the heart of what they're trying to explore in this film, and what happens with Kenneth Branagh stops thinking with his theater dick and starts thinking with his brain.
Exactly that.
This is interesting. I love the creature's question where he says, I can play the flute and I have no idea why. Where does this rest within me? The brain of the person I was couldn't play the flute. Was it my hands? Was it my shoulders? Was it my heart? Where was it? I think that's fantastic. I think that's interesting stuff.
I think that's a morality question that is powerful for the film, but in life in general, the people watching it as well as the people in the film, the characters going through this is like, you start getting into that, I want to say, metaphysical part of reality, mm-hmm. where what are we other than energy in our brains? And then what does that control?
Yeah.
Is my ability to be a cartoonist or an actor or any of that inherent to my brain, to my heart, to my left hand that draws? Like, where does it come from?
I have so many things that are very similar to my family members. I have a very similar sense of humor to my family members. I have a very similar work ethic to my family members. And I'm very proud of where I'm from. That's why I joke about it, but I'm very proud of where I'm from. And yet at the same time, I have parts of me that are so different than anyone I grew up around, you know, that are so odd and far away. Like, my interest in horror, I can't tell you where it comes from. You know, I could tell you where my interest in action movies come from, but like, mm-hmm. my father sitting me down and telling me about horror movies was an instant fascination with me. I can't say it came from him. He just kind of like pushed it along the path.
Right. Yeah.
But it was there. It mm-hmm. was there. Where did that come from? I have no idea. So these are all really, really interesting questions. And there's a beautiful line in here too, when he explains how he feels. The creature says, I have love and rage. If I cannot satisfy one, I will indulge the other.
Mm-hmm.
This is the movie I want.
And that's where it should have gone. That's the connective tissue that we're missing.
Right.
They're so big on their budget, and they're so big on their sequences, and they're so big on their drama and their big theater. They're not taking the time to give us these nuances that make the movie gel.
So the latter half of this part is going to be Victor and Elizabeth trying to escape the creature. First of all, I hinted it in the narrative. I have no fucking idea what happens to Ian Holm's character. I have no idea. He's just in bed and he's clearly dead and the creature is standing over him, but it's not clear at all that the creature killed him or if Ian Holm died of fright or if Ian Holm has been replaced by some sort of pod person that is just staring just off into the wilderness. Waiting. I have no idea what's happened. Do you have any interpretation on this whatsoever?
None. I barely noticed that he had died, very much like I barely noticed he existed in the fucking movie or what his character was.
I would have just literally had the creature kill him because I actually really like mm-hmm. when the creature just starts destroying Victor's life. I find it to be horrifying and I find it to be really like it really engages like like my heart. And I think if in this version of it, if you've created such a sympathetic Victor, I think that it could have been really tragic. I would have literally just Absolutely. Had the creature grab Ian Holm's face and just crush it.
Yeah. That would have served so much better to the film as a whole, but also to the characterization of the creature who's working on which moral dilemma is important, which moral path do I follow?
Yep.
I want Victor to take me seriously, so I'm just going to kill this guy and prove to him I fucking mean it.
And Victor's already broken his promise, which that whole fucking thing is way too quick. It's literally like Victor makes a promise in the ice cave, rebuilds the lab. It's clearly the only point of that promise is to have him rebuild the lab. And then he rebuilds the lab, and then he immediately goes back on his promise when he refuses to use Justine's body in the experiment, which the creature's right. The creature is the one that says, hey, you said that these were just body parts and they don't matter. So
that was a great line. I love that because he's thrown Victor's own morality in his face.
Yeah.
It's like, you said they're just bodies. When it suited your purpose, when it suited your needs, they were just bodies. They were just things. You didn't have to get attached to them. Why is it a problem now?
Yeah. Too bad Robert De Niro delivers it like he's chewing on marbles, but it's a good line. It's a good line. I can't believe Frank Darabont wrote this script. Did you see that?
I did not. No.
Yes. Wow. This might be the first time that you and I have ever said bad things about a script that Frank Darabont wrote.
Now I feel double bad now. I feel bad talking about De Niro with bad acting. I feel bad talking about him bad scripting. Like, shit.
Look, damn. I blame whoever the other person was. It was co-written.
Yeah, sure. Maybe that's it. Darabont came in and like did the good parts.
Maybe. I don't know who the other person is. Maybe they were the good one. I don't know. Maybe Frank Darabont was struggling this year, but
could be. Everyone just had a bad time. That's all. 94 was a tough year.
But Victor and Elizabeth escape. Now, we haven't really done much with their relationship, which is actually a big part of the movie. And I don't really know how to describe them. They're brother and sister, sort of, kind of, through adoption.
All I can say is it's either this or teeth. When you're going to adopt a kid who's not blood related to you, there's no real morality around this happening, except that they were raised as brother and sister.
Yeah.
They were raised as family. And yeah, you're not technically literally related, so you can do whatever you want. But it's weird socially to have that happen. But it's one of the reasons I didn't dive on it with this narrative, is it's ambiguous to the overarching problems of the film, I guess. But also, it's so strange in the film itself and the way they handle it.
I think that sometimes it doesn't serve discussing a movie to talk about morality that just was not present at the time. You and I talked about, we defended Blackula because they said things about gays that were not like perfect for 1970.
Right.
Whatever. It's a great movie.
Less perfect now. Yeah.
Yes. You know, but also, like, let's say, for instance, it was a biopic on Edgar Allan Poe. Like, Edgar Allan Poe married a teenager. If you're going to do an accurate story on him, I don't feel that I need to spend a lot of time talking about how disgusting something is when we know it's disgusting. And also because the movie is trying to be accurate to a certain time period. In fact, sometimes I find when a commentator needs to, like, talk about that excessively, they're more just sort of doing it for themselves or doing it to like hedge themselves against the audience than they are actually trying to engage with the story and just understand that like morality just was, you know, morality has evolved.
There are plenty of reports and historical documents in the 1700s and earlier of people, you know, getting married, having children, and the people they're marrying and having kids with are a lot younger than them.
Yeah. Or their cousins or different things like that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's
just the way it was back then. I'm not saying I agree with it now.
Yeah.
But our society has changed from then till now to the point where we no longer accept that as a good thing.
But what's so hard when you're watching this movie is that every time Elizabeth and Victor have a scene together, it's so like sweeping. It's like the music like comes in and like wind is blowing through their hair.
Gone with the Wind.
It's so over the top. And it's like this like romantic like moment. Mm. But their lines are so like grotesque. Like, and they're so like vomit inducing. They'll look at each other and they'll kiss passionately. And he'll be like, I love your lips. I love you. He's like, I love you so much. And then he's like, what are we to each other? Brother, sister, or lover?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh.
If she answers brother and sister, then how do you feel?
Right.
Like, what's going on in your brain then?
Right. If she said she was like breathy when she said it, she's like, brother and sister. You're like, oh, not where I wanted you to go with that.
I kind of was hoping you weren't into that. All right. Well,
yeah, like they just have so many lines like that that are just so difficult to listen to. Like, again, they kiss passionately and he says, are you my sister, lover, or wife? Like, not a question that you ever want to, like, not something you want to mix up.
First of all, if you don't know, that's a problem.
Right.
Secondly, if you're asking her, that's a problem.
Right, exactly. Like, that's only a question you want to ask if you have amnesia, not like...
That's right. If I just woke up from a coma, I'm allowed to ask that.
Right, exactly. You know, different things like that. So their love story is hard to buy into. I don't necessarily think that Helena Bonham Carter and Kenneth Branagh have bad chemistry. But also, even if you just forgot the brother and sister thing, I mean, their love affair is so like a violent seizure. It's everything is so like shaken over the top, and they're kissing, and then they're like sort of frantically dancing around, and then they're dancing in circles, and they're running, and she'll run away, and she'll be like, oh, Victor! And then she'll sort of like playfully like run back to him. It's just kind of like frenetic and all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you.
So it's not necessarily bad or poorly acted. It's just really hard for me to get excited about, even if I can forget the nature of how they're related to one another.
Through all of this vaguely incestuous love affair, they're trying to get away from the creature who was able to get to Geneva before them, so I don't understand how they think he can't follow them across town to this little cabin they're staying in or whatever. But there's this dramatic sequence of the creature coming in through the skylight to Elizabeth's room, dropping on the bed, discussing with her the deal that he made with Frankenstein. Somehow the people found out Frankenstein's creature is in the room. I don't remember if they heard the crash through the ceiling or if they just go, better go check on her. Let's bring a mob with me. I don't know. But they found him up there.
You know what it is? It's that they look up and see her window is open, which again is why like movement and time make no sense in this movie, because he's laying on the skylight. She's like, oh my God, there's a monster on the skylight. And that means he had to like quickly climb down into her window. And then she did nothing but, you know, like panic and lay there
for it to happen. Yeah. So through all the odd events, what happens is that the crowd comes up the stairs. They bust into the room. The creature's lying there over the top of Elizabeth and says something to Victor. I forget. Punches his hand into her chest, pulls out her heart and says, fuck you, Victor.
With less words.
Right.
He just says, fuck you.
That's it.
Looks right at, fuck you. Did you fuck my wife?
That's what it was.
Yes. This also is just another one of those moments where I like her death. I get where it takes the story, but it's just so hard to take it seriously that he rips her heart out and then hands it to Victor and it's still beating. And it's just like so racked with symbolism. I actually get that that's partially how he kills her, because he can't destroy her head, because his whole intention is that if I kill Elizabeth, he's going to try to bring her back to life and then she's my bride. Right. But it's just so like eye roll. Wah, wah.
Exactly that. That's 100% what it is. Yeah. You might as well have had cut her head off and had her still talking to him. It was the same kind of thing.
It's just the idea like somebody like wrote that part. And like Kenneth Branagh was like, I know, he'll rip out Victor's lover's heart. And then he looked up into a mirror just like he did in part one. And he says, I'm brilliant.
he's rubbing his chest. He's like, I'm such a good writer.
Oh. Right. He's wearing that same outfit that he wore in the lab with the black leather pants and I called it the Buffalo Bill frock.
That's right. Exactly.
Just rubbing his chest hair.
Fuck me.
I'd fuck me so hard after writing this brilliant script.
I'm telling you, it's a great affirmation.
We will.
You gotta try
it. We will.
Hey! Hello. Welcome to 100 Horrors, a comedy podcast that seeks to rank the best 100 horror films of all time, as dictated to us by a poster that one of us owns.
Every week, we bicker over another film in an attempt to give it an overall scare factor and secure its place in the 100 Horrors list.
With features such as... And...
What would you say to them at a funeral?
We take a light-hearted approach to horror cinema so that it can be enjoyed by even the most squeamish of listeners.
So whether you're the person who's never seen a horror film in their life or the person who has a tattoo of Leatherface on the right ass cheek, there's something to be enjoyed in every episode of 100 Horrors!
Victor takes Elizabeth's body back to his lab, and after a dramatic montage, brings her back to life. The creature arrives and demands her to be his bride. She screams, realizes what she's become, and douses herself with lamp oil. Elizabeth is consumed with fire, and Frankenstein's estate burns to the ground. Back near the North Pole, Victor finishes his story and conveniently dies the minute it's over. The captain speaks to his crew before finding the creature crying over his creator's dead body. They hold a funeral on the ice with Victor laying on an unlit pyre. Because the movie needs one more dramatic moment, the ice begins to break and the creature falls into the freezing water. He grabs a torch, swims to Victor, climbs on the ice, and raises the flame high into the air before lighting them both on fire. Captain Walton turns to his men and tells them that instead of continuing north, they will go home. The movie ends with the ship sailing away, leaving behind the flaming pyre where the bodies of Victor Frankenstein and his creation continue to burn.
What symbolism. Wow. So moving.
I know.
So dramatic. I was blown away by how much I did not care about the end of this fucking movie.
This,
my God.
This is a film that I started off being interested, and then I'm just laughing harder and harder and harder by the time I get to the end. So I will throw out one compliment for the end of this movie. Again, to the beautiful set design and also the makeup design. I'm not really crazy about the way the creature looks. The way his skin is sort of like burned skin that is stitched together, it just doesn't really do it for me, but Elizabeth looks fucking great.
I like where they were heading with it. They wanted to do something that wasn't just flat top bolts in the neck Frankenstein. And they wanted to show body parts being fused together.
Mm-hmm.
So the creature has two different eyes, two different color eyes, for example. What's interesting about Elizabeth's makeup, and I want to compliment it because it speaks to one of the positive things of the film here. He did such a rush job on Elizabeth. Because heartbreak, but also bringing her back to life was for Victor, not for the creature.
Right.
No matter what promises he thought he was going to keep, this was about him getting her back.
Yeah.
So you can see bits of brain are exposed and such. Like he did a very fast, we're going to cobble this together and make it happen. I kind of like the notion of a Frankenstein's creature that genuinely looks like different parts of people put on one body. And they were really aiming for that in this. I'm not going to say they hit it 100%. I'm not going to say it was brilliantly done. But I'm going to say I want to give a lot of compliments to the people for making the effort to make it really happen. Because you're right. Elizabeth, at the very least, looks amazing right now.
It sounds like we're attracted to her. Like, whoa. Like, upgrade.
Give me that Fangoria magazine. I got to go to the bathroom.
You said something in our first episode on this that I really liked, which was that you referenced the time period in which these classic monster movies were being remade. But they were being remade in lots of different ways. Bram Stoker's Dracula is the opera this movie wants to be. And I really like that movie, but I recognize that that is a movie that is meant to be seen on the biggest screen possible and is meant to be watched from as far away as possible. It is just huge and larger than life. And then you take that and compare that to Brendan Fraser's The Mummy, which literally does not know how to not have fun. That movie is fun in a syringe. This movie is trying to be both of those things and failing on both sides.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to imagine a world where the Frankenstein movie took the Brendan Fraser route and made this movie fun, really leaned into the steampunkiness of it, kept some of the, you know, good scenes and good dialogue and ideas, but like really leaned into that. I think that this ending scene would be amazing. I think that this ending scene would be great.
100%.
But it's a kind-hearted fart at the end of the movie. Like, this scene almost works, kind of. I do like that it slows down a little bit for Victor to try to get Elizabeth to understand who he is. But at a movie that's been moving at like 200 miles an hour, it just doesn't really fit with the rest of the film. And it's too bad because it's just like, it looks great. Like, it looks amazing. And then you've got this big dramatic ending that happens. Mm-hmm. This could have worked in a different film.
There's that double-edged sword we talked about a little bit earlier on in this, where the movie up until now has been so disjointed and fast-paced and everything else that we didn't really know what to focus on or where to go with it. This scene kind of works. Interestingly enough, she comes out of the vat fully clothed. I don't know why. The other one had to be nude, but whatever.
He does put a dress on her. He does put a dress on her.
Oh, did she? Okay.
He puts her
I
wedding.
She just came out with the dress on.
Yeah.
It's not about the nudity. I just thought it was funny.
It's a little homoerotic there. The creature was nude, but she wasn't. We'll put her in some clothes.
Her coming to the realization after their little dance that Victor does with her, suddenly she's realizing she's alive. She sees the creature and goes to him for a few moments, like takes a few steps in, and then Victor calls to her, and then she's like, oh, wait, I recognize you. And there's this genuine conflict in her, like, am I supposed to go to this creature,
yep,
or am I supposed to go to Victor?
I like that.
And then she starts getting that repulsion from the creature. She's like, no, that's not, no, I can't be there. But that in turn leads her to realize who she has become.
Mm-hmm.
And now, even though she's like him, she still doesn't want to go to him, but she doesn't want to go to Victor anymore because Victor fucked her up.
Right.
And that's rude.
Yep.
So this wonderful conflict and this wonderful moment here, and I thought it was played out so very well, but to your point, it is such a contrast to the fast-paced, disjointed shit that we've seen throughout the entire film up to this point. It doesn't work. It should have worked, but it doesn't, because it doesn't fit with the rest of the movie and what they were doing. It doesn't have the same timing, pacing, whatever else to it. So it feels out of place, even though it's a great moment.
This was the only scene that I remembered as a kid that actually played out the way I remember it. That I remember it feeling tragic, and I remember it feeling like they had tied on this little bit of Bride of Frankenstein onto the movie, because I just was unfamiliar with those stories at the time. So I was like, oh, they tied a little bit onto the sequel onto this, because I just didn't know how it all worked. So I agree with you completely. But even then, I still have some questions. Like, the reason that she figures out like who she is that she reaches up to touch the creature's face, and then she realizes that she has these stitches on her arms because her hands have been replaced. And I thought to myself, why on earth did he replace her hands?
Yeah.
He replaced them because she's supposed to have Justine's body, but then Elizabeth's head on there. So I was like, what did he replace her? Why did he replace her hands?
I had actually thought about this as well, because earlier in the film, we see Justine's body as he's pretending to follow through on his promise to the creature. And she's laid out on a slab. And when he's getting Elizabeth brought back to life, you see him cut her head off. She was hanged.
Right.
That's all that happened to her.
Right.
So all you got to do is stitch up the heart into the chest.
Yep.
Put a new head on this body. You're good to go. I don't even know why Elizabeth had that big welt over her eye or some of her brain exposed. I don't know how bad he was at putting this head on the body, but he clearly fucked up along the way.
Yeah, maybe she had small hands or something. He was like, you know what? While we're here, imagine if he had given her a giant rack.
As long as I'm getting Elizabeth back, let me make some improvements.
Yeah. Well, she wakes up. Have I got news for you? Like,
you're not going to have those man hands anymore. I'll tell you what.
Can you imagine if the scene had shown like Elizabeth's face in close up? She's like, what? And she's got like all the stitches and all the bruises. Uh-huh. And then it pulls back and she's got like two giant tits and then stitches around the like perimeter of the boobs.
Oh, that's funny. I just had this horrible thought. Do you suppose, because it was her left hand that she reached with, he wanted the one that had the ring on her finger? He wanted her hand with the ring on, so he cut it off and stitched it on.
Yeah, I did wonder that. I also thought to myself, you know, rings are removable. Like,
also, like, that was a bit overboard. Because honestly, that would be fucking horrible. That's not romantic. That's dumb. Who cares?
He has the medical ability to hook a brain up to a body. He couldn't have just put a new heart in Elizabeth's body? Like, I'm just confused.
I don't know.
But it does get to just the moment, when you have a moment when you think this movie is working, one of the things that I just love about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is that then it just has another hilarious moment. So Elizabeth takes the lamp oil and lights herself on fire, but it's the shot of her running out of the house.
Yeah.
And not only is she accidentally like hitting the walls and lighting the house on fire, which I'd be fine with, it's that they have put this together so poorly that the house is lighting on fire regardless of whether or not she's touching the walls. And as she gets halfway down the corridor, an explosion happens in front of the screen and fireballs shoot up, and she hasn't even reached that point of the hallway yet.
Because the key phrase is there, the fire happened, the explosion happened in front of her.
Yes.
She hasn't got to that section of the room yet,
yes,
or the hallway, and things are, that's dumb.
Yeah.
That is just dumb. I'll forgive her quote unquote accidentally bumping into the walls where it looks like she dramatically slammed herself into each wall,
yep,
on the way by.
Right.
But that's dumb.
Right.
You can't have fire before fire.
Right, exactly. Like, this looks like an Arnold Schwarzenegger film. Like, this looks like Commando.
I did like her dramatic drop off the balcony to the floor below so she could set the place on fire from the exact middle of the house. That was nice.
Right. It looked like she went for all the oily rags. Like, it went... Like, she lit herself on fire and then just threw herself into every, like, floral arrangement and tapestry and oil can and every single, like, every oil drum that they had inside the house.
I like the idea that she had just enough forethought, even as this new creature, to be like, I've always hated this fucking painting. I'm going to run into that. These curtains are tacky. I'm going to run into those.
Yeah, she like runs into the bathroom and practically like throws herself on every roll of toilet paper they have and every roll of Bounty tissue paper. And like, but this brings us back to the North Pole for, again, one last big swing. I never didn't think it was funny that Victor finishes his story and then he's like, I'm so tired.
I've gotten this soliloquy done.
Yeah, right. Like, again, that's such an actor thing. That's such a theater thing to be like, I've finished my monologue. Goodbye.
And it always ends with,
right. I must sleep now. Like, what'd you die out of? Like, did you die from like running out of acting skills? Like, what did you die from?
No, it's all the hot air in them has finally escaped. So they're gone.
You could say that he died of hypothermia, I guess, but he's been in the lower decks of this ship for now, what, hours? Like, and he seemed fine earlier.
I might be mistaken. He might have been sitting next to the guy, but I think he was lying in bed, like under blankets and stuff. So hypothermia, they were working on it. They were getting him warm.
And,
you know what I mean?
And again, like, he seemed fine earlier. All he had was frost makeup on his beard and like a slight chill.
Yeah. He's like, achoo. Sorry. Excuse me.
Oh, God. It's just so dramatic. It's so full of itself.
Fucking creature comes in and is like, my father, which is a whole other pile of bullshit.
This, okay, when the captain came back down below decks and saw the creature there crying and he said, my father died, I buried my heads in the pillow and I said, I've had enough. I can't possibly understand why this is the last reaction. If they just brought the drama down a little bit, And let's say that they had carried his body out, because they have to carry his body out. They can't leave a dead body below deck. They carry it out and they see something standing there in the wilderness. And it's watching. They kind of figure out, oh, it's the creature from the story. They don't do any of the bullshit with all the ice breaking up or anything like that.
They
just set up this pyre. But then the creature walks over and wants to light it and feels complicated feelings about his creature. I would have bought that. About his creator, I would have bought that.
Sure, sure. You know? I would have been just as happy with them leaving Victor on the ice to the scenario you just painted, having the creature stumble out of the fog, grab him, and drag him off.
And maybe the ship, the captain watches it, and that's what makes him go, oh, the story is true. I need to question my own role in taking people, you know, farther than they should go. Like, where is my hubris and my sense of adventure and discovery? Where have they kind of crossed over?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, that would have been great. That would have been strong.
Right.
I would have liked it.
Because I do like that the creature dies at the end. I kind of like the fact that they both die. But I don't know. I feel like there is something that they could have done where they could have put Kenneth Branagh's character on a pyre, but then the creature is the one that lights it. I like that.
Sure.
I like that.
That would work too.
Mm-hmm. And then you get, because I like that shot of them sort of like sailing away and just seeing these two burning bodies. But even then, now that I think about it, I kind of like your idea too, that they just leave them on the ice and then they're thinking about going to the North Pole.
Or like maybe they're building the pyre or something, but his body's there.
Right.
And they see the creature walking towards the camera.
Mm-hmm.
They all stop because they're like, oh shit, what's about to happen?
Right.
And he just lifts up the body of Victor and walks back into the mist.
Yep.
And that's it. It like maybe shoots the captain a dead, like deadlock. They lock eyes, you know, for just one moment.
Right.
And there's a tear and then he's off.
And I would not have the creature have the line of saying like, oh, that this is my father. I would have the captain say that line because then you can question whether or not the captain is correct, but it still clues the audience enough into the emotions that are happening for the creature. So you don't have this ridiculous idea that the creature thinks of Victor as his father, which is ludicrous.
Especially, I got born, I went into the woods, and the family rejected me, so now I want revenge for some fucking reason on Victor, and my whole story is about revenge on him, but now he's my father and I'm sad. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't fucking jive.
But if the captain had said it, then it's the captain's interpretation of events, and then what's happening is that you're clued in that something complicated is happening. Okay, the creature has many different feelings right now. And sometimes when people go through their revenge quest and then they finish, they just kind of have nothing left.
Right.
And it's actually kind of like a anticlimactic for them. I would have been okay with that. I would have been totally okay with that being the ending. And it's just implied that they sort of both die out there in the cold. You could have shown that the creature was frozen over. You could have made it clear that they both die out there.
Or just leave it ambiguous so you set yourself up for a sequel that would never happen. But, Leo, there it is.
Oh, yeah. They could have Henry come back. They could have Henry.
Exactly.
Because God only knows what happens to him, too.
Exactly. That's my point. Everything in this movie is so up in the fucking air, they could have set it up nicely.
Just real quickly for our audience, Henry, the best friend, who is in a lot of the movie, he is just literally left on the stairs crying at one point, and then the entire building burns to the ground, and I have no idea what happens to him.
Yeah, the rest of the movie, no mention of Henry at all. Gone.
Yeah. I'd like to think that he is the main character of our legacy sequel, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein 2.
That's right.
Yes.
he's the ghost that's crying on the stairs every time they go in the house.
Exactly. All right, Leo, one final time, and then we seal Mary Shelley's Frankenstein back into the amniotic fluid. What did you think of this crazy, wild ride?
I liked Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Mm.
I got to see it in the theater, and to your point, it was the opera we wanted. It was what it was advertised. I'm not saying it's a perfect movie. No movie's perfect. But it was good, and I enjoyed it. When this movie came out, along the same thread of let's give new life to these universal monsters, I would have expected more from it. I don't remember why I never got around to seeing it. I don't know if it just slipped me by or if I just was like, ah, fuck that film or whatever. Never got to it in the theater. It was now that I've seen it for the first time. And maybe my perspective back in the day would have made it different, but boy, what a not good film. And while I can appreciate the movie more now than maybe I had done in the past, and there's no denying that the film was fairly solid in a lot of areas, acting, score, etc., for most part. I mean, some of the acting. But again, strong cast, strong talent, all that shit. Still, it lost me towards the middle, so much so that I had to force myself to get to the end. And that says a lot about any film, if you're going to do it. And what's strange about that is that the movie is so fast-paced, which should be good and keep you excited and keep you invested and interested, but it actually had the opposite effect. Things move so quickly, and they were in such a hurry to get anywhere with this fucking movie that they spent little to no time on character development. There's no breathing time to connect with the main characters, so you don't really get the chance to care as much for them. And when you do see some things happening along the way to impact them, you don't get any time to relax or reflect or see how someone like Victor is digesting the things that are happening. It's like the movie was afraid to have a longer runtime or lose anyone's attention for more than 5 minutes. So they just crammed everything they could in at a fast pace. It's like they were jangling a bunch of keys in our face to get our attention the whole fucking time. You know what I mean?
Right.
I feel like I'm repeating myself and beating a dead horse about it, but I just don't feel like we got as much insight into the characters and the creature as we did in the book. And that's me with the vague memory of the book. I haven't even read that in years. I think this movie was aiming to be 12 different things, and it should have just been one solid thing. And I wish it had been better. I really do. I see the potential in it.
I've decided after watching this movie that I do need to go and revisit some memories of my childhood and just make sure those movies are as good as I remember them. Because I really don't want to recommend them if they're not. I think I might start with Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, because I remember really liking that movie when I was a senior in high school. And I am really questioning that after watching this movie. Look, I find this movie to be laughably bad. So I had fun. This is the first movie that I can remember that we've covered that is bad because it is too much. Not bad because it wasn't enough. I mean, you and I have covered, we've covered Fatal Games and we've covered Iced and all these like garbage movies, Metamorphosis, that are just terrible. And they're terrible because they're extremely low budget and they have no imagination and they are just poorly put together. And then we've covered the, you know, realm of movies that are so bad that they're good. I can't think of another movie that we covered that was, had this level of budget behind it and was this bad.
Yeah.
You know, we disagreed somewhat on Subspecies. I just like that movie more than you do, but even you didn't think that that movie was nearly like this.
I mean, not at all.
I can't think of anything else that's like it. This just doesn't work. And it's too bad. There's money to be spent here, and you can see that they're spending it. There is good costuming. There's good makeup. There's good set design. Ah, the camera's fine. You know, the camera's fine. The camera's used mostly to hide things that characters should be able to see. I just got so caught into this river of remembering what it was like to work with pretentious theater people that I couldn't get out of it. And that was just simply all I could see when I was watching this movie, was just the self-importance.
Yeah.
And it's too bad, because I think if you had gone more one way or more the other, you could have had a really good time. You could have had a Bram Stoker's Dracula, or you could have had something like the Universal Monster movies that have their own level of, you know, playing to the rafters and are a little dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't really know what this movie's going for. I think Kenneth Branagh probably wanted to tell the story of Frankenstein and was very caught up in his own ego as an actor. And in doing so, thought he was making the movie more interesting for a modern audience by adding these action sequences and making all of the music swelling because he didn't think that the audience would really grab onto the text if the movie wasn't like really pulling us along the journey and making it very clear that Elizabeth is my character's lover and the creature just pulled out her heart and that matters because they were in love.
Yeah.
That he just didn't think we would get it. He just didn't think we would go along for the ride. And maybe people wouldn't have. Look, audiences are not always great in their assessment of stories. But man, this movie sucks. Like if we were on a cut above, this would be a suck, not a fuck. Like this is not a good film. But I will tell you this. If you are a recovering theater person, like Leo and I are, if you're in theater people recovery, this movie will make you laugh a lot. I'll tell you that. You will laugh your ass off watching this movie and watching Kenneth Branagh dressed like he's Michael Flatley screaming live, 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 live at a bunch of electric eels in amniotic fluid and Robert De Niro maybe giving the worst performance he's ever had.
And I'll give the movie at least that nod. Because I want to be fair, and I don't necessarily want to end on a bad note, but it was entertaining. It was something to laugh your way through. If you don't take it seriously, you just watch it. And I would put this on any Roger Corman style film or any other like laugh your way through it movie. Those movies we talk about where grab some popcorn, get some friends, have a movie night, shit on the film, have fun. That's what this is good for. And it at least has that going for it. I wish Branagh didn't Mary Sue his way through the movie. That would have been better without that shit. But alas, here we are. So, better luck to the next film, I guess.
Oh, man. We are not necessarily moving on to a better film, are we?
What's great about this is we have our May lineup ready to go. We're not necessarily jumping out of the frying pan into a fire, but we're not getting into a better frying pan either this month.
Since we didn't do this previously, why don't we take a moment and announce our movies for May? So, Leo, you want to go first?
My first pick for the month of May, I have chosen what is a cult classic, if nothing else. I'm going to go with Warlock.
Ooh, we're doing Warlock first. Okay, that's awesome. I thought we were doing it in a different order, but Warlock.
That's okay.
Warlock is a movie that is near and dear to my heart. Of course, we actually were going to cover it several months ago, but we decided to put it off for reasons that the horror community is well aware of. But it is a movie that Leo and I adore. This movie. We were doing a different movie first. So don't take what I said. Because I love Warlock.
It might be that I just wrote it down in the other. These might not be in the right order. It's okay.
Fine.
But whatever. Mine Warlock's on the list.
Mine are in the correct order because after whatever Leo does, we will be doing for our 125th episode, the original, The Hills Have Eyes.
Which is a phenomenal choice.
Yeah, it's a movie that I adored as a kid, and thankfully I watched it recently, so I know it's still good. There is no sweeping music, no brother and sister love story, nobody runs around shirtless.
Perfect. It's already better than this movie.
I don't know, maybe Michael Berryman is shirtless and I just don't remember. Anyway,
My next choice, I'm going to pay homage to another actor that I admire, no matter how shitty the movies that he's in. And I'm going to bring us The Prophecy.
The Prophecy with Christopher Walken.
That's the one.
I saw the movie in the theater. Yeah. You're not talking about any of the 12 direct to video prophecy movies that came out after that.
Not at all. The original one that was actually okay.
And Leo was very clear with me when he told me this. He said, not the one that you plan on picking, which is about a mutated bear in the woods, which he is correct. I do plan on picking that movie at some point, and Leo has assured me he never will.
It's all yours, buddy.
After that, look, we're big on social media. You know, we've got people that are messaging us all over the place being like, please show up at my grocery store. Please show up at, you know, this, that, do a cameo. Like, you know, we're pretty big. And people are always just clamoring for us to do this film. And so finally, I've relented and we're going to give the fans what they beg for. And we're going to do Witchcraft 3.
Oh, hooray.
Oh, Leo's like, what happened to William Spanner? What happened to him?
I can't wait
after
to
Witchcraft
find out.
2.
We, at least I, had a nice surprise to find out that the month of May allows me 3 choices. And because I wasn't ready for that when I picked the other two, I wanted to find something complimentary and also wanted to either continue the torture or cleanse the palate of Witchcraft 3. So I figured, since I've done the other two movies each May that we've done the podcast so far, I will finish up with The Omen 3 on this one.
Which, unknown fact, I have never seen.
Oh, that's going to be such a delight.
But hilariously, I have seen The Omen 4.
Which I have never seen and just don't plan to. So.
Well, get over that, because I'll definitely be picking it. It has one of my favorite bad movie, horror movie moments ever. And I will tell, for anybody who's seen the horror film, the Omen 4, in case you thought it was a drama or a romance, the detective's death where he dies because a wrecking ball comes through a building and hits him, I think is one of like the epitome of when the Omen jumped the shark. Like, it is.
Well, we have that to look forward to someday.
Yes, exactly. Someday. I do want to end a little bit with a thank you. So obviously a couple weeks ago, we had Nate on our Dollman and Demonic Toys episode. And then, oh my God, it's so fucking funny. And then of course, a couple weeks ago, we had, you know, a couple months ago, we had Charlie on for Subspecies. You know, and I just wanted to throw a thank you out to both, you know, the Give Me Back My Action and Horror Movie team, but also, you know, just other podcasts in general that we've worked with, like Horror House and whatnot. You know, when we have people on our show, it's very different than when we go on other shows. You know, when we go on other shows, you know, there's just this kind of idea of like, oh, you go on and review the movie. But for us, it's almost like being in a sketch. Like, we have to plan it in advance. And it's very silly and it's very goofy. And I've got, you know, I've got a couple others that I want to do down the line. I've got one that I've planned for a certain shark-based show. And I've got a couple of these planned, and I just wanted to say thank you for the people, you know, Brianna and Dyson over at Dark Adaptations. I coughed. It wasn't that I forgot their names. But like, they, you know, they were willing to sort of like play along on our goofiness, and that actually takes a lot of work. And so I just wanted to say thank you, because you, when you're on Spoils of Horror, it's always a lot harder than just being like, just review the movie. Like, and we've got a couple more of these down the line that are going to be fun, but I do appreciate when people take the time to be on our show and do the goofy things that we ask them to do.
Thank you all for putting up with our shit. It's good.
So we'll see you next week for whatever Leo decides was supposed to go first.
Either The Warlock or Prophecy. We'll flip a coin, you'll figure it out.
We'll see you then.
Bye.